Okay, so hello everyone, and I want to first of all say that it's nice to be with you, even if it is virtually. Would have very much liked to have been up in San Francisco this week and having the opportunity to see you all. So we'll do the best we can here virtually. I always feel a certain level of connection with my childhood whenever I think of the San Francisco ecclesias, Belmont ecclesias particularly, and fond remembrances of being a little kid at the Boulder Creek Bible School, sneaking around, getting banana slugs and all those good things. So it was, it's certainly a good memory for me. So we're going to, we've compressed these classes, and in a way, I am worried, this is my worry, that it's going to be like trying to take a drink out of a fire hydrant. It's going to be a lot of material. I'm going to try to pause at times where some of the points are going to be made, but I will be very pleased to send at the end of the day copies of these slides. I'll send them to Brother Ted and he can distribute them. If anybody sees a slide that they say, and I really didn't understand what he was saying, or there was too much for me to grasp on that slide, you might want to review the slide. So that's what the commitment is. Just in terms of what we're going to be talking about, it is going to be about this Second Temple period. Interestingly, it covers quite a bit of time. And there's the chronology, as you'll see, is all over the map. I gave these classes the very first time up in Canada, and when I gave them, I landed in with Mary Kay in the, I think it was in Vancouver, and the person that was there at the customs area said to me, "Why are you going here? Are you being paid for this?" And he said, "What are you speaking on?" And so I told him I'm speaking on the simple the Second Temple period. And he said, "Why did you pick that?" And I said, "Because I didn't know better." So it's a period that actually is a little bit complex, but when you put it together, it is this remarkable period of time. And I hope that it'll be helpful to you. So we're gonna talk about the call to return home. In the first class, we'll look at the work of Haggai, particularly a little bit of Zechariah in considering your ways and the day of small things. We'll then turn our thoughts to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah in class number three. We'll look at the time of Malachi in chapter four, and then kind of bring our thoughts to a conclusion with the day of small things. And then finally, we will, or what it's like to live now in the day of small things, I should say. And then finally, we'll take for the exhortation a look at this incredible passage that happens with the return back to the land of Ezra at the River Ahava. There's a lot I think we can learn from our ecclesias. So why this study? Well, there was a time for me probably 10, 15 years ago where I wasn't really very happy with myself. And to be perfectly honest, I really wasn't happy with what was going on in our ecclesia. And it felt like we were misaligned, like things just didn't seem to be going the right way, either for me or even sometimes in my ecclesia. And so I really was struggling for a way to look at this. How do we deal with the fact that the standards that we see for what our lives should be and lives in the ecclesia should be, we fall so short? And how is it that we're supposed to deal with that kind of mentally? And so what I hope to be able to share with you is this wonderful message that comes out of the Second Temple period, which I believe teaches us the right way to look at all of our shortcomings, to recognize that we don't give up, to recognize that all of us are a work in progress, including our ecclesias. And really, what we should have always in mind when we look at things that aren't going exactly right is the great day ahead when the Lord, when he returns, will make things meet the standards. And this is really the beauty, I think, of this. This quote, it's obviously a secular quote from Santayana, and it was basically this: those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Well, actually, I think if you actually think about that, that is a part of what we do with the scriptures. But if you think about it, now I hate to show these because I know that the forest fires have been very close by for many of you, but we think of the beauty of the forest and we can recall to mind places that were gorgeous, that were destroyed by fires. And yet we can also see the promise of new life. And when we see that new life, what it does is it allows us to remember what the past was like and be able to look forward to a future. Now, we may not see that future when that little tree is looking like that first picture, but nevertheless, it allows us to try to do three things: to go back and look at the past, to look at the present, and to be able to look at the future. And this is the skill that we are encouraged to have when we read scriptures. Yes, look at the past, understand what happened historically, but then look at your life today and ask yourself, what can I learn from the past? But that's not all, because that's where George Santayana would take us. What we're expected to do is also look at what the future is going to be. And understanding the past and understanding where we're headed in the future, it helps us to have a better picture of where we are today and how we should live our lives today. Okay, so as we think about where the reason that we have the scriptures, Romans chapter 15 is a great place for us to visit, for we're told that for whatever things are, were written aforetime, were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. So as we read through these passages that are going to go back some 2,400 years ago, our hope is that it will help us to have greater patience and more comfort in our lives today and a stronger hope. So why this study of the Second Temple? Why is this one useful for us today? Why does this allow us to look back and also to look into the future as we look at our current times? Well, the very first thing, I'm going to see if I can get rid of this. There we go. The very first thing is the period of time that we are going to be looking at, they were waiting for the Messiah. Not his return, but his first coming. So there's some similarity there. The clock was ticking down as they were waiting for the Messiah. Another big piece of this is that they were all in Babylon and they were feeling pretty comfortable. You know, they weren't where they wanted to be, but they were generally comfortable and living pretty affluent lives. And as they finally get back down into Jerusalem, they start to build the second temple. It is actually physically a bigger temple, but it didn't measure up. And when people began to look at it, they actually were kind of disillusioned when they looked at the new temple, and some of them remembered the old temple. We're going to be looking at a period, and it happens over and over in Israel's history, I suppose in our own lives too, where self-examination is broken. And they're just not able to see and to tell holiness versus sinfulness. You know, this is during the time of Jonah. You might remember that at the end of Jonah, it talks about how God says that the people of Nineveh couldn't distinguish between their right hand or their left. And that really kind of is a problem that exists for believers throughout time. You cannot have self-examination broken, being able to look inside and to be able to discern holiness versus sin. And of course, when that happens, it typically leads to decay and apathy about the things of holiness, maybe even rationalization. We saw that leadership had failed at this point, and leadership was critical, not only at that time, but to get them out of the hole they found themselves in. And there was a great need for reform and for Reformation leadership. There's different types of leadership, and we'll talk about that as we go. And the need at that time was for Reformation leadership. So as we look at this, there really are three temple periods. There is the first one, which is Solomon's temple. Now, by the way, all the dates that I put on these things, you have to take with a grain of salt, because as you'll see in a few moments, it is almost impossible to know when these dates actually did occur. You can either believe the scholars, the biblical scholars who put dates together, or you can believe the Jewish scribes who really worked hard at keeping the chronology straight. But if we look back at the three temple periods, there's Solomon's temple, there's Zerubbabel's temple, which remains until Herod actually comes in and demolishes that temple and builds his temple beginning around 19 BC and going through about 70 AD when it's finally destroyed. So these three temple periods, we're going to be talking obviously about the second one. I won't spend much time on this except to say that the way our Bibles are written obviously is not in chronological order. As Sister Millie will tell you, we are doing the Bible readings as a group. As we have about 25 people or so that participate, and we're doing it this year chronologically. And I got to tell you, we're in Genesis, and that's pretty straightforward. But as you can see, when you get into some of these periods, you see that there's so much overlap. And the period of time that we're talking about, even though much of the writings come before the Psalms in our Bibles, are actually way at the end of the Old Testament period. So this is going to be confusing. Please forgive me. But what we're trying to do is demonstrate that we're really talking about the period of time after the prophecies are actually concurrent with the prophecies of Daniel and Ezekiel and that last second temple period. Here's another way of thinking of the period. When we read 2 Chronicles and we read Jeremiah and Daniel and Ezekiel, what we're reading about are prophecies that are dealing with the fall of Judah and the promised future return and building again of Jerusalem. And I think it's important to say here, it's a little bit of a spoiler alert, it's not just temple, it's the whole city, the walls, the streets, everything. And then we get to the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi, and these are the very different in what they're talking about. They are exhortational, and they're talking about the need for the urgency of them to get back to work, to complete the temple, complete the rebuilding of the city, and to be ready spiritually. And then finally, we get to the period of Ezra and Nehemiah, and this is really about the actual work, not only the rebuilding of the temple, not only the rebuilding of the walls and the city, but the spiritual minds of the people. And this is a fantastic period for us to be able to read about. So hopefully that'll be a little bit helpful as you consider the time frames that we're dealing with. One of the best things for us to recognize is that when we go back to the prophecy of Daniel, what we understand is that there is a clock that is ticking. And they know that there was this prophecy of 70 weeks. And they were told in verse 5, 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublous times. So you see, what they understood and maybe had to be reminded about was that the building of the city, the building of the wall, the restoration of the city of Jerusalem and the temple was associated with a time frame that would lead to the coming of the Messiah. Now, I'm going to take you through some chronology, I should say, and it's not intended to be like putting you on the rack for torture. Sometimes I find chronologies are kind of like that, but it really is intended to really kind of help us to better understand the story a little bit and to put things in place in our minds. So here's a problem. The Jewish calendar today for the year 2022 for us says that it's been 5,781 years since the creation. So while we may think it's been roughly 6,022 years since the creation, that's not what the Jewish calendar thinks. And because of this, you can imagine there are going to be significant differences in the years that are given. And that's why we have such a confusing timeline. We always think of David as coming into his kingship right around 1000 BC, but the Jewish calendar puts that around 877. That's a gap of 133 years. And it continues, as you see, to be a big distance apart between Hezekiah, the prophecies of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. When we think of the burning of the temple, whether it's 586 or 587 BC, we kind of think that that's almost like a historical fact that we can put a stake in the ground on. But the Jews believe that happened about 423. So you can see as we go all the way through that there are significant differences in the biblical timeline, the biblical timeline based on the Jewish calendar and timing versus what kind of is the traditional biblical descriptions. So what do you do with all that? I mean, how do we make sense of all that? Here's what I'd suggest. The years aren't that important. It doesn't matter whether or not the burning of the temple was in 586 or a different year. It's really all about the relationship of the events that we should focus on. So in other words, when we look at the context of what's going on, what's happening on a contemporary basis? And I think what's beautiful about that is when we step back and we look at it, we see so many of these prophets that are contemporary with one another, that God has a person who is in Babylon telling the people of Israel about what's going to come on, and that's Ezekiel. And he has a person down in Judea, in Jeremiah, telling the people of Israel there what's going to happen. They're contemporaries, and we're going to see this as we go through, that it isn't important about what year it was, but that they were all about the same time. And so that's what I think we can take from these timelines. Now, here's another one with years on it, but it's important also for us to be able to understand that there's a lot of people with names, and they have a bunch of names that can be confusing. So when we hear about the time where the captives first began to return to the land, it appears it's Cyrus II when that happens, whatever the time zone is. When we hear about the adversaries writing to the king and asking for the work to stop during the time of Haggai, that is this guy who only reigns for a period of 6 months. He's an imposter. He was a magi, and he was killed by Darius I. And it's Darius I that I would like to suggest is the great Darius the Great, the Artaxerxes that we read about. He's the same man who has different titles. And I hope to demonstrate that as we go through. One of the real reasons we get mixed up is because a lot of the names are names of kings that sometimes are for their fathers and their grandfathers, et cetera. But I'd like to suggest that the majority of this story happens with this man, Darius. Darius the First, Darius the Great, Darius, son of Hystaspes, and Artaxerxes. That is the man. And he reigned between about 522 to 486 BC. At least that's one of the time zones that we can go with. So that is the one that we're going to read about as part of the story. Now, here's the problem. We read about this in places like Ezra in chapter 6 and then chapter 7. And we read about Darius the king, who's also in the next chapter called Artaxerxes the king. But they're really the same person. Darius the king, Darius the first, Darius the great, is also Artaxerxes. And so we see as we go through kind of this interchangeability in the names. And it's also interesting that if we understand that, then when we see a person like Nehemiah, who we're introduced to his work in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, this is not like 30, 40, 50, 60 years later. This is a period of time that is concurrent with Ezra. And this Artaxerxes is also that same Darius the first. So I hope I haven't confused you. I hope I haven't bored you at the very beginning of this of these classes, but I think it's important for the following reason. They are contemporaries. They're contemporaries. So if we look at this, the first exiles return. I'm going to throw a year at it. The temple is finished. We have Ezra's work, and then we have Nehemiah's work. It would appear to me that the first exiles return around 536 BC. The temple is finished about 20 years later. Ezra's work is right after that period of time, and Nehemiah's initial work happens about 502. Why is that important? Well, we can start to overlay some things. So as an example, these would be the years of the kings of Persia. And then we can look at the stories. It really is a period of about 34 years from the first exiles returning to the work of Nehemiah. You have Esther that falls right in that period. You have Haggai and Zechariah and their prophecies that fall right into that period. And then finally, Malachi falls in that period also. So as you can see, it's a compressed time frame. The difficulty with this is that sometimes you'll look up, people will have studies that will say, well, the exiles started coming back around 536, but Nehemiah didn't come into the land to do his work until 444. Well, that would mean that Nehemiah couldn't possibly be one of the first exiles to return, and that's inconsistent with scripture. And that's what we see here, because when Ezra talks about the ones who first came out of Babylon, we hear about the following names in verse 1, chapter 2 of Ezra. Now, these are the children of the province that went up out of captivity, of those which had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away into Babylon, and came again into Jerusalem and Judah, everyone into his city, which came with, here's the names, Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, and you can see the rest of the names, including a name that we find in the book of Esther, which is Mordecai. All right, so that's kind of interesting. These names, which figure in this time frame, if we go back to that last slide, you can see very easily how they could fit into that time zone, that people like Zerubbabel, a person like Mordecai, and also a person like Nehemiah could all have been part of that initial group who initially came down. And so if we were to try to take this, and this may be going a little bit too far, the name Zerubbabel actually means sown in Babylon, or a descendant of Babylon, or as Thayer says, born at Babel. So if we were to look at this and say, if Jeconiah, who is the grandfather of Zerubbabel, was brought to Babylon in 597, and Zerubbabel was his grandson, the oldest that he could be when he comes down to be the governor of the land is about 61 years old. That's the oldest he could be, and he's probably younger than that. Okay, so is he the same Mordecai? I've heard a number of people say, well, it's a different Mordecai, but he's got to be the same Mordecai. He is from the tribe of Benjamin. As we read in Esther, he was also from the tribe of Benjamin. He'd been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah. So there we have, he's the same kind of contemporary that had been that had been associated with Zerubbabel. So this is an account that links his family to the captivity. He's likely born in Babylon, just like Zerubbabel. Now, why is that important? Well, we read the story of Esther. It's a beautiful story. It's a little bit different story, isn't it? But actually, he's now not down in Jerusalem during the story of Esther. He's back up in the city. So he's now back up and in Shushan, and Esther, the events of Esther happen, and he's probably in his early 50s. And this is before the temple actually has been finished. So there's something going on here. He goes down with the initial pioneers down to the land, but now he's back with Esther. So what could the story be? Well, here's a possible story. And I find these kind of stories interesting because I can't be dogmatic about the story, but it is a possible outcome here. And that is that Mordecai goes down to Jerusalem as a family leader from the tribe of Benjamin. He goes down to begin the work in Jerusalem and is involved at least in the beginnings and probably the laying of the foundation of the temple. But something happens. He returns to Shushan because perhaps he hears that Esther's been orphaned. And he returns to go back and to take care of her and to raise her. And if that's the case, he's probably not more than his early 50s at this point. Put back into Shushan, but for what purpose? Because he misses out on the final building and the dedication of the temple, but he is in Shushan when Esther has the events that occur and God works his plan to be able to save the Jewish people from the work of Hanam and the attempted genocide. And if this is so, we can see that a man who went down to Jerusalem to be part of that work gets recalled back up to the land of Shushan, to the city of Shushan, and is in the right place at the right time to be able to save the Jewish people. That's a possible story. And if it is so, we can see the hand of God and the work of the angels working in the life of this man. Well, so we go on into Ezra chapter 1, and we read that as they were going back into the land, they take silver and gold and goods and beasts, precious things, and also this important statement, and that is that Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth out of Jerusalem and had put them in the house of his gods. We'll deal with this a little bit later, but this is a really important thing. And it really takes us all the way back to the land of Shinar and the competitive temple between the temple that was being built in the land of Shinar versus the temple that would have been associated with Shem. It was the vessels of the house of the Lord that had been lying in the house of Nebuchadnezzar. And God permits those same vessels to be able to be returned back down to his house in Jerusalem. Now we're given a list of returnees in Ezra chapter 2. And it's quite an interesting list. They didn't all go. In fact, I'm not sure what the percentage was, but I have to believe that it was a low percentage of people who actually returned back. Israelites are mentioned by family or they're mentioned by place of origin. And we have names of priests and Levites and singers and porters, the Nethinim, Solomon's servants. And we have many who it says were of doubtful descent. And we'll deal with this later on. And unlike the reentry that they had under the time of Joshua into the land, they wouldn't be permitted to go and claim the land from other people. And they would have to endure great material suffering. Remember at the time of Joshua, they went into the land and they were able to take over the cities, with their vineyards and all of the riches that these nations had. Well, that wasn't going to be the case here. And so there's about 42,000 people who are heads of households, likely 29,000 from Judah and Benjamin, and estimated about 200,000 in all that go back in this first wave that leave Babylon and return. This must have been an incredible experience for those first people. It was a frightening experience because they weren't going there without without some risk. But there was a list of those in Ezra who were not found by genealogy. And this had been really in the period that they were in Babylon. Though there were probably many who were likely from priestly families, they had retained their proper identification. That was really important. And that might seem like a small item to us, but I can assure you it was important to them because being able to be a priest and to be able to do your work and to have that particular role, it would have been lost while they were in captivity. We read about one who was the son of Koz who had to marry a daughter of Barzillai, the Gileadite, just to be able to be called by her name and lineage. And so their priesthood was considered polluted and unable, they were unable to eat of the holy things. So there were a number of people who could have gone back as priests, but frankly, they had just kind of lost their identity while they were in Babylon. So when they get back to Babylon, where is it that they actually, when they come back from Babylon, where do they actually settle? Some of the chief of the fathers, when they came to the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem, offered freely for the house of God to set up in his place. And they gave after their ability to the treasurer of the work 60,100 drams of gold and 5,000 pounds of silver and 100 priest garments. So the priests and the Levites and some of the people and the singers and the porters and the Nethinims dwelt in their cities, and all Israel dwelt in their cities. Now that's very important. They come back to Jerusalem, but not to live in the city. They come back and they decide to return to their own cities. You know, remember that the Levites didn't inherit land and in terms of territories. They had the suburbs around the city that they were given. And they went back to those locations. So you have a real diffused return by these people. And what ends up happening is you have these people who are critical to the work that were dwelling in their cities, not in Jerusalem. And very quickly, the vision of rebuilding the temple and worship would be diverted into establishing their own homes and their own inheritance in the land. And this is something that gets dealt with very heavily during the time of Haggai. Build my own home first. Let me take care of me first, and then I'll get to the work of God. You see, nobody really wanted to live in Jerusalem. It was a mess. In fact, one of the problems Nehemiah has to deal with is he sees the temple's been built, but the walls weren't built. The gates were still burned down. The streets were filled with rubble. And of course, this wasn't what was the promise that they had been told. Now we could go back, we could look at the time of the prophecy of Isaiah, back when Israel, the northern tribes, were still a nation. And what he was talking about to them were really the conditions that he was seeing. And you would describe these as fleshly pride, self-examination was completely broken, and they had inadequate spiritual leadership. That was something that was true for the northern tribes, and that had become true also in Judah. And so what we see is this interesting kind of pattern. And I think it's a pattern that we'll come back to because it's a pattern that we need to be watching out for today. What starts off this pattern is affluence and arrogance. We're comfortable and we think of ourselves better than we should. And that leads to apathy. And whenever you have self-examination broken down and you don't see yourself as you should, and you're feeling comfortable in the land, and you get apathetic, you change your religion. You get apostasy. And the only thing that can come about that could possibly get them out of this is a reformation. So this is a pattern that we see in the North, we see it in the South. We, I think, actually begin to see this in the New Testament times also. And I think it's also possible that we could be looking at some of these same trends today. When we think about the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, the time right before the fall of Jerusalem, what we see is being shown to us over and over to us, all the violations that were going on of the laws, whether it's the Ten Commandments or that we hear about human sacrifices, false prophecies, all these things, it's a catalog of things that you say, how is it possible that it could have gotten so, so far away? How could, this is what you would say is what an apostasy looks like. They have completely changed the teachings and the commandments of God. In fact, that's what we read about when we read about the leaders. It says that the prophets of Jerusalem, he had seen in them a horrible thing. They commit adultery and walk in lies. They strengthen also the hands of evildoers, that none doth run from his wickedness. They are all of them unto me as Sodom, and the inhabitants thereof as Gomorrah. So Jeremiah's message is that the very leaders that were supposed to be committed to keeping them from apostasy and helping them to keep the very commandments of God in their minds and in their forefront of their being, helping them to restart their self-examination, they had completely failed. And so what we're now going to do is briefly look at what happens when they get to Babylon. When they get to Babylon and they're in captivity, what's their life really like? Well, you know what? There was certainly some advantages, and God knew this. We read in the 137th Psalm about how they would sit down by the river and they would remember Jerusalem. They would long for what they remembered about Jerusalem. And what they wanted to do is hold on to the vision of a restored Jerusalem. That's something that clearly was on their minds. That wasn't in their minds when they were involved in the sins that they that preceded the fall of the city of Jerusalem. You know, and Jeremiah in chapter 23 talks about this. He talks about the good figs and the evil figs or the bad figs. And it was the good figs that were actually taken and plucked up and put into Babylon. They were the good figs because he put them up there for their good, so that they would learn and be able to change their minds. So what were some of the original initial reactions when they got into Babylon? Well, first of all, as is true in so much of Jewish history, they were secluded. They were separated into camps, into ghettos. But what they saw around them when they got to Babylon was a godlessness and an idolatry in Babylon. And it really helped to kind of refine or to define who they were versus the idolatry and the fleshly pride of Babylon. It's interesting that after Babylon, when they come back into the land, the idol worship that we saw prior in the time of Ezekiel and Jeremiah, which got all the way into the actual temple courts, that doesn't seem to come back. This is something that actually is eradicated generally from Israel. And of course, they have a face-to-face opportunity to look at the consequences of their sin, to be aware of what they had lost, and then to recognize that they really needed to be focused on the promise of a return back to the land. But you see, as time passes, what happens is, you know, they set up their own Jewish infrastructure. They found where to get the best bagels. They found out where to be able to go to find a priest, to be able to do all the things that they needed to do, to be able to feel like they had kind of a Jewish settlement there. And it allowed them to settle by the Kibar River, which might have been nothing more than an irrigation ditch, to be able to build and to farm. And interestingly, they actually had a better standard of living in Babylon than they had for many, many years when they were back before the final invasion of Nebuchadnezzar. And during this period, they're relatively free from persecution. They could have their own freedom of religion, and they occupied their houses, and they were able to settle into very normal lifestyles. Interestingly, in Leon Wood's book, he said that the institutions were maintained. They now had a freedom of movement. They could write to those who were back in the land and had a reasonable postal system. They had plenty of employment, and they lived in a fertile and well-watered land. So not everybody was going to jump at the opportunity to go back to the area of Jerusalem. And this is the message, that even though God had taken and uprooted them, he put them into Babylon and said, I want you to prosper. And he says, seek the peace of the city where I have caused you to be carried away captives, and pray unto the Lord for it, for in the peace thereof shall ye have peace. So God never left them in Babylon. He was still with them, and he was going to allow them to prosper. And this is really consistent with what we saw all the way back in Leviticus, and Leviticus chapter 26, where we're told, I would not cast them away or abhor them and destroy them, but I will, for their sakes, remember the covenant. So if we put this all together, Israel was really on the precipice of losing everything. And God brought about a severe judgment on them after several stages, each of which they had an opportunity to repent. And he saved many of them and took the good figs and placed them in an ideal location to be able to help them change their thinking and to restore peaceful lives and to put them in a land where they could retain their identity, but also they could see the idolatrous extreme and it could jumpstart their self-examination. And what this really would do for them is get them to look past the past, to look at their present and the need for repentance, and to focus them on the future and the promised return to the land. And so we today find ourselves in such a similar situation, don't we? When we look at the land that's around us that we've been placed in, where we see wickedness and sin all around us. Some people have said that we live in digital Babylon today. And I think that's an interesting way to look at it. What we have to do is use this opportunity for us to be able to discern the difference between who we are and aspire to be, and to stay focused on the restoration when the Lord Jesus will return and establish his kingdom. And so there was to come a Persian window of opportunity. And we know that in Jeremiah 51, we are told that Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon would be destroyed because of the vengeance of the Lord and the vengeance of his temple, because of what it was, not just what happened to Israel, but also the vengeance against the temple. Of course, Jeremiah talked about how they would return back to the land, and that there was this enacting that he would have of the documentation about his land purchase, that there would be a return and a restoration of fields and vineyards. So I think this all sounds familiar. What God does is he reveals his plan for redemption, and he reveals the nations that he's going to use to bring it about, But he doesn't give us all the details. He provides us with an outline and an understanding of the time frame. And he asked Israel to believe in his power and the surety of his plan, to trust in him, that they would be able to watch the plan unfold and take comfort that there would be soon a return to the land, but that they needed to be watchful and ready and not allow themselves to be entangled in Babylon. Well, of course, we know of the promise all the way back in Isaiah chapter 43. Thus saith the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, for your sake I have sent to Babylon and have called down all their nobles and the Chaldeans whose cry is in their ships. I am the Lord your God, the creator of Israel, your king. And so, again, the promise that Jerusalem would be rebuilt, not only the temple, not only the foundation, but the city itself. And of course, this proclamation of Cyrus was at nearly 150 years before the actual birth of Cyrus. And of course, I won't spend much time on this except to say that he had been surnamed even though he had not known him. And I think that's kind of important. Some people say, well, based on the proclamation of Cyrus, he must have been a God-fearing man. I don't think there's any evidence of that. In fact, I don't think he was a God-fearing man. But what we know about this man is he lulled the Babylonians into inactivity during his war with Lydda. And there was a potential, he was seen as a potential ally for Babylon. And he took maximum advantage of internal difficulties that were going on in Babylon. While they were focused internally, he set a military campaign against Babylon. And it was almost like an anticlimax, because Cyrus marched into the town in the late summer of 539 BC, seized the hands of the statue of the city god Marduk as a signal of his willingness to rule as the Babylonian and not as a foreign conqueror, and he becomes hailed as a legitimate successor to the throne. That's who this Cyrus was. But the interesting thing about the Cyrus cylinder is what we read about how he gives a level of freedom of religious and actually civil rights, we might say today, and that people should not be oppressed because of what country they were from or what their religion was. And because of this setting, what happens is Israel is able to return to the land, because we see in Second Chronicles that God stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. And we see that all the kingdoms of the earth hath the Lord God of heaven given me. He hath charged me to build him an house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And so in Ezra 1, we read about the Lord stirring up the spirit of Cyrus. Ezra 1:5, he does the same thing for Judah and Benjamin. So who's in control of this? Who's the one that's making this all happen? Clearly, it is our God. And so the proclamation again is that the Lord God had given him, allowed him to build a house of the Lord in Israel. And I want you to remember that rival temple, because we heard about the land of Shinar all the way back in Genesis chapter 11. We hear about it in Daniel chapter 1, when these vessels were taken into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And now we see with the work of Cyrus that they're going to bring those same vessels back. And that's what we read in chapter 6, that the golden and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took forth out of the temple, which is at Jerusalem, brought unto Babylon, were going to now be restored and brought again to the temple. All right, so that's where we'll leave it for this class. Our next class is Consider Your Ways. And what that means is we're now back in the city of Jerusalem. The foundation of the temple is being laid, but the work is going to be stalled. And that's where we see the work of Haggai.